Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present author Rahul Mahajan, who takes a critical look at the Pentagon's counteroffensive launched against insurgents in the costly occupation of Iraq. Karen Hansen-Kuhn, international coordinator with the Alliance for Responsible Trade, who assesses the outcome of the Free Trade Area of the Americas Summit meeting in Miami, where tens of thousands of protesters were repeatedly attacked by police. And Gail Shearer, director of health policy analysis for Consumers Union, who explains why her group and many others opposed recently passed legislation authorizing a drug benefit in the nation's Medicare health program. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
In the weeks before the Free Trade Area of the Americas talks in Miami, Coast Guard officials boarded the Greenpeace boat MV Esperanza and prevented it from entering Miami's harbor. According to OneWorld.net, at the time of the Miami incident, Greenpeace was already under attack by the United Nations-based International Maritime Organization, which wants to kill the environmental group's consultative status for allegedly engaging in unsafe shipping. Meanwhile, Attorney General John Ashcroft is pressing a criminal case against Greenpeace for sailor mongering under an obscure 1872 law. The charges were a response to a 1992 incident when Greenpeace boarded a ship that activists claim was hauling illegally imported mahogany wood. The International Maritime Organization began its effort to expel Greenpeace in 2002 under pressure from countries who were targets of Greenpeace campaigns against unsafe tankers. A final decision on Greenpeace's status will be made at the IMO Assembly in London in early December. Greenpeace counters that IMO consultative status was never revoked to industry groups like Interanco, the Trade Association of Supertanker Owners, in the aftermath of huge oil spills like the 1989 Exxon Valdez incident and the breakup of a tanker off the coast of Spain last year that caused over $5 billion in damages. As a Greenpeace spokesperson responded, "Unlike the oil industry, we don't put other people's lives or the environment at risk by our actions." For about 100 years, more than 100,000 Native American children were forced to attend government-run Christian boarding schools. Children as young as 5 were separated from their parents and placed into the boarding schools. According to Amnesty International, the Native children were subjected to strict rules, often abused, and forced to assimilate into white society. The first Indian school was opened in 1879 by Captain Richard Pratt, a veteran of the Indian Wars and an advocate of forced assimilation of all Native peoples that stripped them of their customs, language, and culture. Physical abuse was common at the Indian boarding school right up to the mid-1980s. An FBI investigation found that John Boone, a teacher at a Hopi day school in Arizona, had sexually abused as many as 142 boys from 1979 to his arrest in 1987. Last April, 6 Sioux Nation members claiming sexual and physical abuse at the government-run boarding schools filed a class-action lawsuit. They are demanding $25 billion in damages for hundreds of thousands of abused children. Lawyers for the plaintiffs say there are over 100,000 victims in South Dakota alone. As Sammy Tianita, a Lakota and a founder of the Boarding School Healing Project, argues, it is one of the grossest human rights abuses because it targeted children and was a tool for perpetuating cultural genocide. According to Mother Jones magazine, 250,000 children took Prilosec, a heartburn drug, in the year 2000. There were also 100,000 prescriptions written for so-called proton pump inhibitor heartburn drugs like Prevacid and Nexium. Despite the U.S. Food and Drug Administration's warning against children taking Prilosec due to the risk of pancreatitis and possible liver problems. Children's use of prescription drugs has grown by 30% since 1997, according to a study by Medco, the nation's largest drug management company. And in 2002, prescriptions for children grew faster than any other category. A growing number of doctors and medical researchers are worried about the harmful effects of strong drugs on children's bodies. For example, clonidine, a blood pressure medication, is now given to children with ADHD and so-called sleep-resistant babies. University of Maryland researcher Julie Mangozito explained, "No one is tracking what effect it may have on a child's cardiovascular system to take a drug to speed up the heart along with one that slows it down." This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Denise Manzari.
For several weeks now, the U.S. military has been engaged in a counteroffensive against Iraqi insurgents codenamed Operation Iron Hammer. While the Pentagon maintains that their more aggressive tactics in Iraq have reduced the number of daily attacks targeting U.S. forces there, American soldiers continue to die in ambushes and roadside bombings. Critics warn that the Army's use of high-tech weaponry to blow up buildings and the demolition of homes suspected of being used by insurgents and their allies could backfire by increasing the average Iraqi's resentment against the U.S. occupation while fostering support for anti-American guerrilla fighters. This claim was borne out in a recently leaked classified CIA report, which concluded that Iraqis are losing faith in the U.S.-led occupation, leading to more sympathy for the insurgents. The White House has reacted to the deteriorating situation in Iraq with plans to speed up a transition from American rule to an Iraqi provisional government handpicked by the U.S. In a recent New York Times editorial, Max Boot of the Council on Foreign Relations recommends that the U.S. adopt tactics used in the Vietnam War, such as the infamous Phoenix Program, where the CIA assassinated more than 26,000 supporters of the communist insurgency. Between the lines, Scott Harris spoke with Rahul Mahajan, author of the book Full Spectrum Dominance, U.S. Power in Iraq and Beyond, who takes a critical look at the tactics used by the Pentagon in confronting the growing insurgency challenging the U.S. occupation of Iraq.
What's happened is that the United States, not content with already a pretty significant level of repression, has moved to an entirely new level of attacks on targets, not necessarily because they're clearly seen to be military targets, but also just as shows of force in response to the numerous incidents in which large numbers of U.S. soldiers were killed recently. The United States has set out to essentially to terrorize the Iraqi population, to show them, as one officer said, that we have teeth and claws and we're willing to use them. That's in a nutshell what Iron Hammer is, and it's interesting that many of these techniques being used right now by the United States in this occupation bear a great resemblance to techniques being used by the Israelis, including the use of F-16 strikes and dropping 500-pound bombs on houses. And what this signifies, I think, is it shows the desperation of U.S. policy, and it shows very clearly that the occupation is not going well for the United States. It's interesting that every time there's a big attack by the Iraqi resistance on the United States, you hear words from the White House to the effect that this shows the desperation of the Iraqi resistance and they realize they're losing, which is ridiculous, of course, because what it shows actually is that they are more able and willing every day to attack target and to successfully execute what they're trying to do. But the U.S. show of force is very clearly a sign of desperation and shows that the United States is losing control of the situation because, of course, in situations like this, the amount of resistance that you get from the populace is directly proportional to the brutality and the repression that you use on them. And escalating at this notch that they have done with Iron Hammer is just very clearly going to lead to more resistance, and the United States is getting itself caught in this spiral which is going to lead out of control.
I would go on to ask you about something you mentioned just a moment ago, the similarities that we see in the U.S. occupation of Iraq with some of the tactics undertaken by the Israeli military in their occupation of Palestinian territories.
Yeah, there's numerous parallels. One that was first reported on, I believe, in May was the taking of hostages. In particular, the first case that got some coverage was an Iraqi lieutenant general the United States was after, and in order to get him to turn himself in, his wife and children were taken hostage. This is, of course, you know, blatant violation of the laws of war or the laws governing an occupation, and also of basic decency. But the United States did it in that case, and since then, it's become reasonably common. If they do a raid on a house and the person they're looking for isn't there, it's quite likely that they will take someone else to get some leverage to get that person to turn himself in. So there's one similarity. There was a stunning similarity reported in August in Dulaya, which is a town about 50 miles north of Baghdad, where local farmers who were supposedly, according to soldiers, not giving information about the resistance had their date palms and their orange and lemon trees cut down. This is a blatant violation of the Geneva Conventions. There's a stunning resemblance, of course, to the Israelis' destruction of olive trees in Palestine.
There was a recent poll conducted by the CIA, or the CIA had reported on a recent survey of Iraqis, and their view of the U.S. occupation painted a pretty dismal picture. Can you provide some details for us?
Basically, the poll showed that a significant majority of Iraqis very clearly think that this is an occupation, not a liberation. Three-fourths of Iraqis roughly believe that the so-called Governing Council is really a puppet body controlled by the United States. And I think these polls pretty much tell you whatever you need to know. The majority of Iraqis are firmly against the occupation. They don't like what's happening to the country under U.S. rule.
There are a lot of comparisons made to the U.S. Involvement in the Vietnam War, the Long War in Indochina. It was interesting to note that the New York Times last week, Max Boot, a senior fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations, suggested that using tactical operations seen in Vietnam, such as the Kit Carson Scouts and the Phoenix Plan, where tens of thousands of Vietnamese were killed. What do you make of this kind of proposal in the pages of the New York Times?
I don't think it's surprising at all. All of the talk about how this was the liberation of the Iraqi people and were doing it for their benefit was just a thin veneer of propaganda. And when the United States is hurt in some way, when it seems that the cost, either in lives or in money, or in this case in both, of the occupation is too high, then it's very natural for figures in the mainstream, and Max Boot certainly is in the mainstream, he's not some far right winger, to start suggesting these absolutely atrocious and inhumane kinds of methods. The Phoenix program in Vietnam actually did go a significant way towards achieving the goal of liquidating the politically active groups in South Vietnam. And it's imaginable that something like that, some program of torture and mass murder in Iraq, might actually work the same way. It worked for Saddam, so perhaps the United States should try it too. But that would certainly make a mockery of any claims that this occupation is in any way for the good of the people of Iraq.
That was Rahul Mahajan, author of the book Full Spectrum Dominance, U.S. Power in Iraq and Beyond, published by Seven Stories Press. When more than 20,000 protesters converged on Miami to voice opposition to the Free Trade Area of the Americas during a major summit meeting there last week, police had transformed the streets of this resort city into a virtual military camp. As union activists, environmentalists, students, and clergy participated in peaceful and legal rallies and marches, many were attacked by police shooting plastic bullets and wielding batons, tear gas, and pepper spray. An estimated 250 people were arrested, many with injuries. One student from the University of Massachusetts received a severe head injury at the hands of police, but was denied medical attention while in custody. John DeLeon, a past president of the Miami chapter of the American Civil Liberties Union, said, "The government and police treated these people who came to express their views as enemies rather than as Americans exercising their rights." But while demonstrators struggled to make their voices heard outside, delegates from 34 nations throughout the Americas came to the realization inside that a comprehensive FTAA treaty along the lines of the North American Free Trade Agreement was impossible. So negotiators ended their summit meeting a day early and announced a narrow framework dubbed FTAA Lite, which excluded contentious issues such as agricultural tariffs, intellectual property, and rules governing foreign investment. Essentially, Brazil, with support from many nations in Latin America, blocked Washington's blueprint, which demanded that governments surrender their sovereignty to multinational corporations and their quest to maximize profit. Between the lines, Scott Harris spoke with Karen Hansen-Kuhn, international coordinator of the Alliance for Responsible Trade, who was in Miami for the FTAA summit meeting. She discusses the widespread opposition to the Washington-driven FTAA and why the result of this summit is a victory for those who oppose corporate-led globalization.
In terms of the official meetings, what was really clear is that certain governments, particularly Brazil, Argentina, and Venezuela, are really uncomfortable with this framework and were simply not willing to sign on to the extension of NAFTA throughout the Americas. So it looked for quite a while before the meetings like this would be something like Cancun, that there would be no final declaration, that the talks would break down. And in fact, they did manage to come out with a sort of final declaration, but it's very general. And what it says is that instead of a comprehensive Free Trade Area of the Americas, or FTAA, instead governments will sign on to certain minimal obligations, and then there'll be this sort of a la carte approach where they can pick and choose the things they feel comfortable signing on to. So this is very different than what the U.S. administration or the business community had been pushing for years. They had been insisting on a comprehensive FTAA. So this was a big blow. On the streets, well, first of all, we had been organizing for months, different kinds of educational activities, doing outreach around the country. There was a ballot campaign across the U.S. that some 500,000 people voted on. And I remember before we got to Miami hearing, you know, that there had been some buildup. And, in fact, all through the local press, what they had been saying was that 100,000 people were coming to tear up Miami. And we had been hoping we'd get 20,000. And we had, you know, all intentions for a totally peaceful march. I guess they used that threat to build up sort of hysteria in Miami, and we were greeted by just thousands of police. You know, I hadn't seen anything like that since I was in Chile during the dictatorship. It was really stunning. And then once the demonstration started, you know, there was a peaceful, permitted march, but the police interfered with it every step along the way. They made us change the route. They harassed people before the march. They wouldn't allow nearly 90 buses of retired people to get to the march. And then afterwards, you know, there were numerous reports of sporadic violence, and people have been hospitalized. Some people are still in jail. So, you know, in the end, I guess the positive thing is we did manage to turn out a whole lot of people, and we had some wonderful educational events, and the governments didn't go along with this corporate agenda. But it was a hard thing, and it was a tough environment.
If you had to sum up the prevailing opposition to the U.S. stated intention for their version of the FTAA, what would it be?
There are several issues that people are concerned about. I think one is people look at the NAFTA model and what's happened. You know, people see that jobs have been lost, both in the United States and then in Mexico, that wages have fallen. They see Mexican farmers have been devastated by floods of cheap corn imports. And, you know, they also see that this model gives foreign investors a lot of new privileges, a lot of new rights with no responsibilities. So they'll gain access to move into countries as they want to leave when they want to, with no responsibility to ensure that this money contributes to local development. This trade agreement, since it goes well beyond just trade issues, would serve to lock in the reforms that have been put in place over the past couple of decades so that even a new democratically elected government couldn't change course. They couldn't decide, for example, that if they already privatized health care, that national health care might be a better way to go, because if they did, they'd have to pay billions of dollars in compensation to investors. There are a range of issues that people are concerned about.
So do you think this was a victory for the Latin American countries that wanted to resist the Washington Consensus WTO NAFTA model, or was this more of a victory for Washington in that they saved some face and didn't have a complete collapse of the talks?
I would say it's definitely much more of a victory for the Latin American governments. You know, they were worried about getting steamrolled into this thing. On the other hand, the U.S. also announced that it's launching bilateral talks with Colombia, Peru, Bolivia, Dominican Republic, and Ecuador. And so they will no doubt be using these bilateral talks, you know, to achieve what they want on a piecemeal basis and to put pressure on Brazil and Argentina. So it's still a pretty complex scenario, but I think it's definitely much more of a win for those who were concerned about the Washington Consensus. And if you look at reports coming out of the business community, the National Association of Manufacturers has objected strongly to this approach, saying this is not what we wanted. So it wasn't a total defeat for the U.S., but I think it comes pretty close.
So what's next for the movement that opposes corporate-led globalization, as evidenced in the FTAA, the World Trade Organization, the World Bank, and IMF?
Well, I think we're going to need to sort of refocus our efforts. I think some of it is we're going to have to look more at some of these bilateral agreements, say with Colombia that's being launched now, or the agreement with Central America that's being completed, you know, and sort of gear up our efforts around those. I think we'll also have to pay close attention to what happens at the vice minister's meeting in February, where they're supposed to flesh out all the details. So I think we need to keep this movement up. I think it's going to be a little harder, because we're going to have to be focusing on more fronts at this point than before. But I think, you know, the issues are the same, no matter which agreement we're looking at. And our alternative proposals are the same also, no matter which agreement it is.
That was Karen Hansen-Kuhn, International Coordinator of the Alliance for Responsible Trade. Contact the Alliance by calling area code 202-898-1566 or visit their website at www.art-us.org. Employing what one Democrat called the most egregious violation of congressional rules in a quarter century, the House and Senate passed a bill authorizing inclusion of a prescription drug plan for the Medicare program just before Congress adjourned for the holidays. For the first time since Medicare was established in 1965, this bill provides some assistance for senior citizens to pay for their medications, but it also contains many provisions that critics fear could end Medicare as we know it. Some of the most controversial aspects of the $400 billion bill include a mandate for private companies to administer the drug benefit, continuation of a ban on importation of cheaper prescription drugs from abroad, and a directive for Medicare to compete head-to-head with private health plans in six metropolitan areas starting in 2010. On the plus side, the bill will speed federal approval of generic drugs and provides increased payments to rural hospitals and doctors. Seniors will get a drug discount card to use in 2004 and 2005, with full benefits beginning in 2006. Beneficiaries must pay $750 a year in premiums and deductibles before starting to save any money on prescriptions. Then insurance would cover three-quarters of drug costs, up to $2,250. And Medicare would pay nothing more until the beneficiary paid $3,600 out of pocket. Between the Lines, Melinda Tuhu spoke with Gail Shearer, Director of Health Policy Analysis for Consumers Union, just before final passage of the measure. She explains why her group opposed the legislation and what seniors can expect down the line with this new bill signed into law.
The big picture is that the bill has so many structural flaws that we don't think can be fixed. For example, it doesn't pick a model that lets the government rein in prescription drug costs, and so we expect that prescription drug costs are going to continue to spiral. Second, it relies on HMOs, PPOs. It relies on the private insurance industry, and in order to get them to participate, it basically bribes them. It gives them huge subsidies, and it guarantees that these special interests are going to come back to Congress every year asking for more. It has a very modest benefit that is not going to meet the expectations of seniors and the disabled. In fact, we estimate that most people who are not eligible for the low-income subsidy are going to end up paying higher out-of-pocket costs in 2007 when they have a benefit than they do today. I could go on and on, but we see it as a flawed bill with problems that are so big and structural in nature that they aren't going to be able to be fixed in the future. The more I learn about this bill, the more troubled I am. When you look at the poorest of the poor, the seniors and disabled who are eligible for both Medicare and Medicaid, today they are protected against copayments. They don't have to pay copayments. This bill will charge them a copay when they get a prescription. They may have 10 drugs a month if they need. They could face huge copays, and these are going to go up over time because they're indexed. So this even covers people who are in nursing homes and have an allowance of $30 a month to pay for anything they might need. They're going to be paying more than $30 a month for these new copays. So that's just one of the many things that is deeply troubling about this bill.
If it does pass in the Senate, what's the next step?
If the Senate votes in favor of this legislation, it will sail quickly to the President's desk for a signature the president will sign it, and then people around the country are going to find out the gory details of what's in this bill and how it fails to meet their expectations.
Now, I want to talk for a minute more about the money. People on the right, some Republicans are opposed to this because they say it's too much money. They don't think this is a good use of taxpayers' money. And then other people, like you, have just said that there's not nearly enough money and to really cover the need. Given the economy and the budget, do you see any possibility in the near future of passing a bill that really would provide what's needed for seniors?
I think the outlook is so very poor, and I think that the die was really cast when the Congress decided to pass huge tax cuts for the rich. And then little by little, we watched the deficit, the looming federal deficit, grow and grow. I mean, it really all comes down to what are our nation's priorities. We think that the logical first step with Medicare prescription drugs would be to figure out how to rein in expenditures, how to get better value for our prescription drug dollars. This bill does the opposite. It sends prescription drug costs spiraling. So in order to get the solution to make coverage affordable for everybody, it's going to cost more and more dollars year after year. So I don't know what to tell you, but the outlook is not very good.
Okay, and I guess my last question is just to say again a little bit more about the whole issue of privatizing Medicare and what that would mean to Medicaid as it has been constituted all these years. Now, I know there's a lot of people who have criticisms of how it has existed, and certainly it could be improved.
Well, just to your question about the privatization, in the early years under this bill, we're going to see more seniors and disabled enrolled in HMOs, private health maintenance organizations, and preferred provider organizations, both of which severely restrict a senior's choice of doctor. And then in the later years, we're going to see an escalation of this and even an increase of premiums for people who want to stay in traditional fee-for-service Medicare. The people who wrote this bill want to privatize Medicare, want to undermine the ability to go into the type of Medicare that gives consumers the freedom to choose the doctor that they want. They have this gut preference for the private sector without holding the private sector to any cost-saving standards. And so this is one of the things that troubles us very deeply about the bill.
That was Gail Scherer of Consumers Union. For more information, call them at area code 202-462-6262 or visit the group's website at www.consumersunion.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced at the studios of WPKN Radio and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests or would like a recording of today's program, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-331-9756 or write to Between the Lines, care of WPKN Radio, 244 University Avenue, Bridgeport, Connecticut, 06604. You can also visit our website at www.btlonline.org. Our theme music was written and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Scott Harris, with the assistance of Bill Cosentino, Denise Manzari, Anna Manzo, Harry Minot, Bob Nixon, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Sasha Summer-Cousineau.